Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, February 26, 2018, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we discuss the oral argument in this morning's Supreme Court Janus case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and will likely be transcribed as well. We're very pleased to welcome back to Teleforum a repeat return guest, Raymond Lajeunesse, Jr. He's the Vice President and Legal Director at the National Right to Work Legal Defense and Education Foundation, Incorporated, right here in the greater Washington, D.C. area. He went to oral argument this morning at the courthouse. He's going to give us opening remarks of about 30 minutes or so. This case has a complicated procedural and historical background as well. So he's going to cover that background and then go on to discuss oral argument. But as always, we'll be moving towards an audience question and answer period. So please have your questions ready for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Ray Lajeunesse, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean. Well, what is it? What's the issue in Janus versus American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees? The question presented is whether the First Amendment permits government to require public employees to also, and they're deprived of the right to make their own contracts by what is called exclusive representation, to also subsidize their state-imposed monopoly bargaining representative. I want to say to begin with that obviously I have a bias in this case because the foundation provided representation for the plaintiff, Mark Janus, but I'll try to be as fair in describing the argument as I can. The case, for us to win the case, it requires overruling Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, which was decided by the court in 1977, a case which, as a very young lawyer, I worked on myself. In Abood, the court unanimously held that a union cannot constitutionally compel non-member public employees to subsidize its, quote, expression of political views on behalf of political candidates or toward the advancement of other ideological causes not germane to its duties as collective bargaining representative, end quote. However, unfortunately, from our standpoint, 6-3, relying on private sector cases, the court also held that public employees can be compelled to subsidize a union's collective bargaining and contract administration with their government employer. I would contend that that really was only a 5-4 decision because Justice Rehnquist concurred only because he had dissented in Elrod v. Burns, which had held earlier that political patronage violates the First Amendment. And he said, quote, had I joined the plurality opinion in Elrod, I would find it virtually impossible to join the court's opinion in this case, end quote. Justice Powell, in his essentially dissent, he concurred in the judgment because of the finding with regard to political speech, but Justice Powell identified two flaws in the majority opinion, which really are the core of the argument that the plaintiff is making in Janus. First, he said there's no basis for distinguishing collective bargaining activities from political activities so far as the First Amendment is concerned because, quote, the public sector union is indistinguishable from the traditional political party, unquote. That is, its decisions reach through collective bargaining, directly impact the level of public services, priorities within state and municipal budgets, creation of bonded indebtedness, and tax rates. Second, he said, by relying on private sector cases, the majority failed to require the proponents of force fees for bargaining purposes to demonstrate that the purported state interest met exacting First Amendment scrutiny. Following Abood, there were numerous cases, all of which were expensive, complex, and protracted, over drawing the line between chargeable and non-chargeable activities, bargaining on one side, politics on the other, and or what procedures are required to protect employees' right not to subsidize union political and other non-bargaining activities. One of those cases is called Chicago Teachers Union versus Hudson, which was decided by the court in 1986, and you'll see when I get to the next case why that case was important. And in Hudson, the court held the First Amendment due process requires that before compulsory union fees can be collected from public employees, They must be given adequate, the employees must be given adequate advance notice of the fee's basis, including an independent audit, an opportunity for reasonably prompt and partial review of the challenges to the union's calculation, and escrow of the disputed fees while those challenges are pending. Well, in our Knox case that was decided by the court in 2012, what happened was that after Service Employees International Union Local in California, statewide local, had sent out its annual Hudson Notice, it imposed a special assessment on all unit employees to oppose two ballot propositions without giving non-members notice that they could opt out of paying the assessment. And the Supreme Court held 7-2 that an additional Hudson notice was required. But, and here's the key, the court held 5-4 that when a public sector union imposes a special assessment or dues increase, it must not only provide an additional notice, it, quote, may not exact any funds from non-members without their affirmative consent, unquote. And the importance of that is that the majority held that opt-in procedure was required because compulsory subsidies for private speech are subject to exacting first scrutiny, making it very clear that heightened First Amendment scrutiny applies, and that they have to serve, whatever the scheme is, have to serve a compelling state interest that cannot be achieved through means less restrictive of free speech and association. And that majority also said, and this is important in Janus, quote, free rider arguments are generally insufficient to overcome First Amendment objections, end quote. And that acceptance of such an argument in Abood was, as Justice Alito wrote, something of an anomaly. That brings us to Harris v. Quinn in 2014, actually involves the same statute that's at issue in Janus, except in Harris, the state of Illinois imposed the mandatory union fee requirement not on public employees, but on non-member home care personal assistants who received state funds. Those were folks who helped disabled individuals, usually their family members, but they're not actually public employees. The Supreme Court, 5-4 in Harris, held that this scheme violated the First Amendment because, what, it did not serve a compelling state interest that could not be achieved through means significantly less restrictive of associational freedoms. In other words, applying exacting First Amendment scrutiny. The majority refused to extend Abood because it found Abood's analysis questionable on several grounds, actually six, all of which apply equally to public employees, we contend. First, the court said, the majority in Harris said, that Abood seriously erred in relying on private sector cases because the First Amendment analysis in those cases was either thin or non-existent. In other words, it wasn't exacting scrutiny. Second, Abood failed to appreciate the judicially noticeable fact that in the public sector, but not the private sector, quote, core issues such as wages, pension, and benefits are important political issues, end quote. Third, the court's majority said Abood failed to appreciate the conceptual difficulty of distinguishing in public sector cases between union expenditures that are made for collective bargaining purposes and those that are made to achieve political ends, end quote. Four, Abood did not anticipate the practical administrative problems that would result in attempting to classify public sector union expenditures as either chargeable or not, problems that the court itself had encountered in cases since Abood, including one I argued called Leonard. Five, Abood did not foresee the heavy burden of expensive litigation that objecting non-members would face in challenging a union's categorization of expenses. And six, Abood's, quote, unsupported empirical assumption that the principle of exclusive representation in the public sector is dependent on union or agency shop fees is unwarranted, end quote. Because, why? Exclusive bargaining agents operate without force fees in federal agencies and the U.S. Postal Service, and I would add in the 27 right-to-work states. Harris did not overrule Abood only because the personal assistants in Harris were not full-fledged public employees. But the court was given an opportunity to do that in a case called Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, which was argued in January of 2016. The Friedrichs plaintiffs were California public school teachers, so it directly presented the question as to whether Abood should be overruled, and the court granted cert to resolve that question. Oral argument, as I said, was held in January of 2016, and legal observers the popular press expected that Abood would be overruled based upon the questioning. But Justice Scalia, unfortunately, died before a decision could issue. And in March of 2016, an equally divided court affirmed the Ninth Circuit's decision following Abood and also later denied a plaintiff's motion for reconsideration, again 4-4. All of this, of course, was before Justice Gorsuch came onto the court. The Janus case was filed actually originally by Governor Rauner of Illinois, who, when he became governor in February 2015, relying on the Harris decision, he issued an executive order prohibiting state agencies from enforcing forced fees and filed a lawsuit for a declaratory judgment that forced fees for public employees were unconstitutional. Obviously, the unions moved to dismiss the case, and the Attorney General, who is a Democrat and a fierce opponent of Governor Rauner's, intervened and also moved to dismiss. We realized that the foundation attorneys were handling the case with attorneys from the Illinois Liberty Justice Center, realized that the governor's case was going to be dismissed because he doesn't have standing. He is not paying agency fees, force fees himself. So we moved successfully to intervene on behalf of three Illinois state employees. The lead plaintiff is Mark Janus, who's a child support specialist for the state and is required to pay approximately $45 each month to the AFSCME union, even though he's not a member, never voted on union representation, and is opposed to the policies for which the union advocates. Obviously, the district court and then the Seventh Circuit had to follow Abood, and we petitioned for cert to the Supreme Court. We lost the other two plaintiffs on the way to the Supreme Court. One of them dropped out in the district court, and the other was dismissed by the Seventh Circuit because he was a religious objector and had failed to raise the First Amendment freedom of speech claim in a suit he had filed involving his religious objection. But that left us with Mr. Janus. And the Supreme Court granted cert in September 28th, identical question that was presented in Friedrichs. And this case has attracted a lot of attention. There were 24 amicus briefs in support of Janus, including an amicus brief from the Solicitor General of the United States, Noel Francisco. And that was a switch from what the Obama administration had done in Friedrichs. And on the other side, 39 in support of the respondents, plus three that said they were for neither party, but actually their arguments really support the respondents. Of course, one of the issues in Janus is, as always, when you're asking to overrule prior precedent, whether stare decisis applies. Our argument is that stare decisis doesn't apply here, just as it did not in Citizens United versus FEC, where the court said that it has not hesitated to overrule the decisions offensive to the First Amendment. And, of course, we argue that Abood is offensive to the First Amendment because it permits the government to compel its employees to subsidize an advocacy group's political activity, in other words, speaking to the government to influence public policies. And, obviously, we've argued in the briefs that Abood should be overruled for the reasons stated in Harris, the six I spelled out, two of which Justice Powell identified as early as Abood. First, the failure to recognize that bargaining with the government is core political speech, indistinguishable from lobbying. And second, that the Abood's failure to follow the court's precedents that subject instances of compelled speech and association to heightened First Amendment scrutiny. And the argument that our counsel made at court is that public sector force fees cannot survive that scrutiny. they're not. He's argued that they're both not the least restrictive means to achieve any compelling governmental interest. Assuming that monopoly bargaining is a governmental interest, it can and is accomplished without force fees in the federal agencies, the post office, and the many right-to-work states that do not prohibit public sector bargaining. And he argued during the argument today that that's because exclusive representation is a very valuable power that unions covet and voluntarily assume. They're the only interest group at the bargaining table. Respondents, both in their briefs and today at the oral argument, did not attempt to show that the fees are a least restrictive means for public sector collective bargaining. Instead, they argued that force fees are subject to lesser scrutiny, what they call the Pickering or Garcetti test, because the fees subsidize employee speech as part of the official duties required by the government as an employer. That's a justification that was not used by the Abood court, which cuts against stare decisis, as our attorney Bill Messenger argued. And, of course, a union is the state's adversary at the bargaining table, so its speech is not government speech expressed through employees. It's advocacy by an independent interest group. So it's not managerial in nature. It's coercion, infringing on First Amendment speech rights. And obviously that requires strict scrutiny, which fails for the reasons that Harris gave, which is our argument. Interesting, today at oral argument, the case obviously is a very important one. There were competing demonstrations outside the courthouse, one obviously sponsored by unions, the other by groups supporting Mr. Janus. Bill Messenger got into his argument 42 seconds before Justice Ginsburg asked the first question, which was, I'm paraphrasing, what about mandatory student fees? And what about mandatory bar dues? And what about the private sector? A three-part question. Bill Messenger responded to that by pointing out that the court in Harris had distinguished all of those other scenarios. Student fees are imposed for a governmental interest, the university's interest in creating a neutral forum for the exchange of ideas. The bar dues support a governmental regulation of the practice of law. And in the private sector, obviously, bargaining with an employer is not political like it is in the public sector. Another three-part question came from Justice Breyer. It was long and confusing, but essentially he was asking whether, you're basing your arguments on recent Supreme Court First Amendment cases like Knox and Harris. How far back do you have to go before a case will be upheld on stare decisis? That was the first part. And the second part was returning to the question of private sector bargaining, whether force fees for private sector bargaining are constitutional. Is there a distinction between the public and private sector? And the third was based on an amicus brief filed by Professor Charles Freed, who is a former Solicitor General under the Reagan administration, actually, who had proposed a quote-unquote compromise, that's what Justice Breyer called it, that you use a different test for what is chargeable in the public sector instead of the vague Abood line between collective bargaining and politics. You allow unions to charge for whatever the statutory duties are that have been imposed on them by the state. Justice Alito pointed out later that was not a solution to the problem because the legislature could simply make the union the monopoly bargaining representative for purposes of lobbying, which, though it wasn't mentioned at oral argument, California has already done. Bill Messenger was followed by Neil Francisco, the Solicitor General, who had 10 minutes of Bill's argument time. The Solicitor General made the point about bargaining monopoly bargaining, working without force fees in the federal government and in the Postal Service. And he also distinguished the Pickering line of cases because there it's just a balancing test, number one. And number two, in the Pickering and Garcetti line of cases, the state is merely restricting employee speech, not compelling them to support someone else's speech. He got a question, not really a question, but a rejoinder from Justice Kagan, who asked him how many times the Trump administration has switched their position in litigation before the court. He was followed by David Franklin, the Solicitor General for the state of Illinois, obviously representing the state's position in conjunction with the union. He was questioned very, very closely by Justice Alito and Justice Kennedy, both of whom were very clearly still on board with what they had signed on to in Harris, that is that Abood was wrongly decided. A very key question was asked of Solicitor General Franklin by Chief Justice Roberts, who asked whether it would not make unions more responsive if they had to attract voluntary support. Of course, he had joined in the majority in Harris, so that would indicate he's still on board with that position. There were more. Breyer again brought up the potential compromise. He seemed actually, I've talked to some of the folks who were in the oral argument, and they felt that the two most active, shall I say, justices were Breyer on one side and Kennedy on the other. In fact, I was told that Justice Breyer seemed to be angry about the case even being there. Solicitor General Franklin was followed by David Frederick, the appellate lawyer who had been retained by the union. His experience, he's done about 40 Supreme Court arguments. He had not represented the union below. Again, he was questioned very closely by Justice Alito and Justice Kennedy, and made what I thought was a very damning concession. Kennedy asked him, does this case, if we rule for Mr. Janus, will it affect the political influence of unions? And Frederick answered, yes. Kennedy then said, isn't that the end of the case? And then Justice Alito pressed him and said, where do you want us to draw the line on when free speech applies to public employees? Where do you want us to go with the claim that public employees have no free speech rights? And he said he was surprised to see that argument made in the union's brief. Chief Justice Roberts, key question from him, and that is, how do union negotiations over the collective bargaining agreement not affect the state budget? And of course, the union attorney had no answer. They had to admit they affect the state budget. And finally, Justice Alito said, wouldn't it be a matter of public concern if union negotiations for higher wages or greater benefits put a public employer on the brink of bankruptcy? And the union lawyer had no answer for that one. And then the final comment that Mr. Frederick made in answer to a question from Justice Alito, he said, well, you know, there's real reliance here because unions and state employers and local governments, when they enter into these bargaining agreements that include forced fees, there's a trade-off. And what's the trade-off, he said? The trade-off is that the union agrees not to strike. Well, that was a perfect opening for Bill Messenger in rebuttal, who said that, in other words, the scheme is a racket protection. You're paying off the union to keep them from engaging in violence against the government. And the only other point he addressed in rebuttal was that grievance processing to enforce public policy, the union bargaining agreement, is just as much advocacy as negotiating over the making of the agreement. So with that, I'd be glad to answer questions, Dean.
Very good. Thank you so much. If you joined us late, we're speaking to Ray LaJeunesse about the Janus oral argument earlier today. Let's open it to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question on the line so far. Let me ask, if I could, just to start things off, a clarifying question. You mentioned mm-hmm. that Justice Kagan asked a question about how often the government had switched its position.
Right.
I assume she was talking about within this case.
No. In briefs filed with the court in this and other cases.
So if I'm reading this right, she's asking about the Trump's administration government in particular, how many times it had switched its government
right.
position since the election results.
Right, in cases before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, interesting. Did anybody react to that? I mean, was there an answer to that question?
I think he said three times. I didn't quite catch it, but I think he said three times. He apparently had faced that same gigging in an earlier argument.
Yeah, it's...
Because he was prepared for it.
Yeah, interesting. Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button. We've got just one question pending, then our lines will be wide
open. Yeah, before you take that question, one other thing that I meant to mention at the start of my description of what was going on at the court today, the line of attorneys to get in to hear the oral argument is the most that I have ever seen, the longest that I've ever seen.
Interesting.
There must have been 100 of us in the overflow room. I was number 77 in the overflow room.
Number 77. Okay. Well, that's good information. We've got three questions now. Let me just quickly ask about the mood after the argument. What were you picking up from the crowd in general? Were you sort of milling with your colleagues on one side of the case, or were you hearing from the other side?
I was hearing from the other side in the sense that the union crowd demonstrating outside had at least one bullhorn, if not more, and they were making a lot of noise. There was a large crowd supporting Mark Janus, which also was making noise. In terms of talking to folks who had heard the argument, I was only talking to, you know, those people who are on our side, and all seemed very happy with the way it went.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, the conclusion everyone made is that there's certainly, although Gorsuch and Thomas, as he usually does, asked no questions, but obviously Thomas had already voted on the same side as Justice Alito in Knox and Harris, and was presumably one of the four who voted to reverse the Ninth Circuit in Friedrichs. Who knows which way Gorsuch is going to go, but with his reputation, one would think he would end up with Justice Alito.
Are you disappointed he didn't ask a telling question, or?
You know, one of the arguments that we thought the other side would make, or that someone from the liberal side on the bench would raise the issue of originalism, mm-hmm. in the sense that when the founders started the country, political patronage, you know, had existed for a long time before it was overruled and struck down in Elrod. But that question was never directly presented. Breyer sort of alluded to it, but it was not. And that was, you know, we figured that argument was going to be one being directed toward convincing Gorsuch to go with the liberals.
Right.
Of course, the answer that we were prepared to give is that the First Amendment cases just really wasn't much First Amendment litigation until the 20th century, and that the Founding Fathers would have been aghast at requiring public employees to support a faction, Hamilton, Madison, et cetera, Jefferson, all wrote that they didn't like factions.
Interesting. We do have three questions pending, Ray, so let's turn now to the audience, if we could.
Sure.
Go ahead, caller.
Oh, hello. This is Arthur Hellman at the University of Pittsburgh. I read through the transcript very quickly. It came online very fast this morning. And what struck me was the way the liberal justices were pushing the Pickering-Garcetti line of cases. And, of course, Garcetti was written by Justice Kennedy. Do you think that if the court does reverse here, that some of the justices who joined the majority opinion, in particularly that case, will start rethinking their view of the ordinary employee free speech case where a single employee is disciplined for speech?
No, I don't think so. Start with the court distinguished the Pickering line in, I believe it was Harris. It was either Harris or Knox. I'm pretty sure it was Harris. And because that had been made by the union attorneys in that case. And I heard from the questioning, I don't know if you caught this as you were reading the transcript, which I haven't had time to do yet because I had to go to a luncheon and then come home to make this call. But the distinctions that I heard from the questioning, I think probably Alito, one, the that line of cases deals with restricting employee speech, not compelling employees to subsidize somebody else's speech. And secondly, that the grievance or a dispute involving a single employee, the scale of it is such that it's not going to affect the public fisc, and therefore it's not as, you know, core political.
I have to say I didn't find that second distinction terribly convincing, that it's that the constitutionality of the First Amendment depends on whether you have one person being disadvantaged or many. The distinction between coerced speech and a restriction on speech does have some foundation.
Mm-hmm.
In the foundational case on coerced speech, Barnett, Justice Jackson said that in some ways being coerced to silence, or in this case being coerced to contribute, is actually worse than being restricted in what you can say. So that first distinction has some basis in precedent.
Well, the second distinction the court majority made in Harris. So they've already accepted it.
It'll be interesting to see whether Justice Gorsuch does. I have to say I was very disappointed that he didn't ask a single question of either side. It's baffling to me since he is so active in questioning in so many other cases.
Yeah, no, it is surprising.
Thank you. Once again, if you have a question in the audience, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending, and then our lines will be once again open. Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, hi, this is John Kupal. I'm Howard Jarvis, Taxpayers Association in California. Obviously, we've been looking at this very carefully. I have not read the transcript, but I was a little concerned about some of the discussion relating to a potential compromise in the discussion from Justice Breyer. That doesn't sound like it's going to get any legs, I hope, because
I don't think so, because I don't think you're going to get Alito, Kennedy, Thomas to go along with that, and I don't think you're going to get Ginsburg and Kagan and Sotomayor to go along with it. I think Breyer's out there on a limb by himself.
Okay, that's good to hear.
Yeah, I mean, it might be tentative attractive to Roberts, but I don't think they can put together a majority.
Okay, thank you.
Let me ask you maybe the same question in a different way, Ray Lajeunesse, and that's the court sometimes seems to be able to dodge some of the bigger questions presented by high-profile cases. Is there a way maybe that people haven't thought a lot about or haven't been the court has been briefed a lot about that you could get to six, one side or the other could get something bigger than a five-justice majority here, and is that attractive to the court?
I just don't see it.
Okay.
The sides are so drawn after Harris. I just can't see that.
Fair enough. We've got two questions pending from the audience, so let's continue to roll through those. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Go right ahead, caller.
Thank you. This is Doug Seaton in Minneapolis. I'm a lawyer representing personal care attendants in the aftermath of Harris in an effort to decertify the SEIU as their current representative. And those PCAs, of course, under Harris are operating under what we could say is the post-Janus environment already, assuming Janus will be decided the way we're all predicting it may be. I'm wondering if there was any discussion of the mechanics of how a decision to overturn a BOOD would be implemented, what exactly the mechanics would be of employees opting in or opting out. We've seen in our battle. No, the answer is no.
At our argument, there was no discussion of that. We addressed that in our brief, and there are amicus briefs addressing that, arguing that it should be, you know, you have to opt in. You can't be required to opt out.
I just thought I should note that we're facing in this battle in Minnesota, and of course another 10 or 11 states are similarly affected, with some significant misconduct, I would call it, in connection with dues deduction authorization agreements that are supposedly voluntary, but that have very limited, in some cases, no exit procedures for the so-called employees to terminate the dues deduction authorization. So it's a very serious question for us here.
Yeah, it's a serious question there. It's a serious question in Washington State, where there's been a lot of hanky-panky involving the governor and the state legislature in terms of authorizing unions to make it difficult for people for the providers to get out, and anticipatorily making it difficult for public employees to get out if we win Janus. So we actually are involved in some of that litigation.
Thank you.
I repeat, if you'd like to join the queue for questions, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines are wide open. Go right ahead, caller.
Hey, so I'm fairly sympathetic to, I think, having the employee unions, these fee structures overruled. But I think the strongest argument I've heard against my position, and obviously your position, and one that I haven't really been able to find a great way to address so far, is the idea that we already subsidize this in a way because we pay for the salaries of the people on the other end of the negotiation table from the unions. So I'm wondering if, I don't know if it came up in argument or if you have any ways that can help me sort of formulate my opinion on this, on how sort of subsidizing the negotiators on the union end is substantially different from, obviously, my taxes are subsidizing the other end of the spectrum and reducing government spending by lowering the salaries. I'm just curious if you have any good responses that I can use or if you have any opinions on it.
Well, the process of collective bargaining is an adversarial process. It makes sense for the taxpayer to pay its representative at the bargaining table. It doesn't make sense for the taxpayer to have to pay for someone on the other side who's advocating policies that would result in the poor taxpayer having to pay more in taxes.
But I guess I'm a little confused because I thought the argument behind this was I shouldn't have to subsidize a position that will lead to raising government spending because of my political thoughts. But if someone on the other end, right, might want to raise government spending and increase salaries and benefits, but the person that they're subsidizing is actually advocating for lowering the benefits slash, you know, lowering the government spending, I'm just confused on how that's substantially different. That's I guess, the main problem I'm having is,
The public employee who wants to pay more taxes because he wants to, say, have his salary raised or some benefit that currently isn't being provided by the state, he can join the union and pay dues.
Yes, I understand that. I guess because hypothetically, right, the argument is the dues are being, you know, when I pay my dues, I'm forced to pay the dues, and that's subsidizing increasing government spending. And if I politically don't believe in that, then that is an infringement of my First Amendment right. I'm confused why the reverse isn't true, even though I understand it could have a benefit for myself.
Well, the
average taxpayer has to subsidize the other end of the argument.
Well, the average taxpayer doesn't have standing to challenge government speech. The First Amendment doesn't prohibit government from advocating its own position.
So then could they instead, so let's say we end the union fee structure. Could governments pass laws where I would, so taxpayers generally subsidize union negotiators and the government negotiators evenly, not the members of the union, but I guess all the taxpayers? Would that be
That would not present a First Amendment problem. It might present some kind of problem under state constitutions with regard to, you know, what the state can do in taxation. I just haven't looked into that.
Interesting.
That would change from state to state. I mean, in the federal government and in many states, you have what's called release time. And mm-hmm. union officials who are also government employees are paid to work for the union.
Gotcha.
So your scenario actually exists in some places already.
Interesting questions, Ray. This is Dean, by the way. And you can layer on top of that, not just the release time or official time, as it's known in some places, but isn't it the case that union dues are tax deductible? So to that extent, the government's subsidizing union membership?
Yeah, if they only the part that's used for collective bargaining and contract administration is taxable, and then only if it exceeds 2% of your gross adjusted income,
including your other business related expenses. So if you have other
work related expenses.
Yeah, those are interesting issues.
Very interesting.
You're welcome, caller. Two questions pending, so let's see if we're heading in a new direction with a new caller.
Hi, this is Jed Brinton. It sounds like, in terms of the outcome, it sounds like it's extremely likely that there will be a 5-4 majority in favor of Janus. I guess my question is, what would you say is the most likely alternative outcome? If you were forced to predict the opposite outcome, that there would be a 5-4 majority in the other direction, you know, which of the five and more the five justices, Gorsuch plus the four who've already voted in favor of Janus's position, do you think is most likely to?
You've got four justices, Chief Justice Alito, Kennedy, and Thomas, who have twice, in Knox and Harris, criticized Abood, essentially saying it was wrongly decided. So I can't see any of them changing. And certainly I got no indication of any change in mind in any of them today. If anything, Kennedy and Alito were stronger in expressing that position, and all the questions that Roberts asked were consistent with the Knox and Harris opinions. So that leaves only Gorsuch, who is a blank slate as far as we're concerned, other than that he's generally considered to be a conservative.
Do you have any sense of what the most likely argument on the other side is that might potentially persuade Justice Gorsuch if he were to decide to vote on the other side?
Well, like I said earlier, we thought in preparing for oral argument and dealing with, you know, questions at moot courts, that there would be an argument made from originalism, because I think there was at least one amicus brief on the other side that made that argument, but it sure wasn't presented at oral argument today.
We've got one question pending now. If you'd like to join the queue, we've got about 15 minutes left. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Arthur Hellman again. You mentioned, this really follows up on the previous question, one of the striking things about the amicus briefs was the amicus brief filed by Eugene Volokh, who was a very prominent mm-hmm. First Amendment scholar, generally thought to be conservative, making the argument that this is really government speech, and so that that Abood should be reaffirmed on that ground. A quick reading of the transcript did not show any reference to that, which is a little surprising to me, because the most recent government speech case was Justice Breyer's, and I would have thought that the liberals might have jumped on this as a way of capturing Justice Gorsuch. But am I right that nobody brought that up at all?
No, that wasn't brought up today.
Were you prepared for it?
Oh, yeah, we were prepared for that. I mean, it's not government speech. It's employee speech. Or it's the employee's money, I should say, that is being used by the union for the union speech. And that's exactly, if you go back to Davenport, which Scalia wrote, was decided in 2007, that was the case which upheld a Wisconsin ballot proposition that required public employee unions in Washington State to get affirmative consent to collect the part of the fee that goes to political purposes. And the court upheld that ballot proposition. Wouldn't have passed in the state legislature the way it's set up today, but it was done at on the ballot by the General Electric electorate. So the union there argued that it was the union's money. And Justice Scalia, in opinion, said, no. This is other people's money that government is giving to the union. So, and that was, I think, 7-2.
I think that's right. So do you think Professor Volokh's argument is inconsistent with? Is that what you were prepared to say if one of the justices had?
Yeah, I mean that was part of the answer. The other answer is then if Volokh is correct, then the Supreme Court's decision is going back to Elrod, striking down patronage, are also wrong.
Yeah, I have to say, I generally think Volokh does some very good work. I was just astonished at this.
Yeah, no, it was very surprising to us. Well, it wasn't surprising to us because he had expressed a similar opinion when the Friedrichs case was in the Supreme Court.
For those in the audience who haven't read the Volokh brief, and this might be too much detail to ask of you, Ray, can you just give a quick recap? I think we're all key to the idea that this he's arguing this is government speech, but how does this become government speech?
Well, that's a good question. The closest I can think is actually that argument, in a sense, was made by the state and or the union in the briefs. In this case, and to some degree an oral argument, in saying that, well, it's the state paying the union to make speech as part of their official, the employee's official duties. The only problem with that argument is it's adversarial speech. The union position is adversarial to the government. So how does it become the employee's official duty speech? Like what the union, the government can regulate in the Garcetti line of cases.
Once again, we've got one question pending now. We've got about 10 minutes left. Push the star button, then the pound button if you'd like to ask a question. Let's turn to another caller. Go ahead, caller.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Keith out in Seattle. It's just noon here. I'd like to thank Ray for putting on this great presentation and the Federalist Society for sponsoring this service, first of all. But
thank you.
But let me say this. I'd like to ask you, Ray, to go back to the initial part of your opening presentation where you described the exchange that ended in one of the parties saying that the unions had agreed not to strike as part of the deal. We see teacher strikes every year. The Chicago School District is paralyzed, it seems like, every other year by teacher strike. And so I'm not sure how any union has ever agreed not to strike as part of any deal, any public employees union anyway. So would you just kind of review that line of reasoning?
Well,
argument?
Yeah, the attorney, and it was the attorney for the union, asked me, was suggesting, and I haven't seen the contract myself, that particular contract with the state of Illinois that covers Mr. Janus includes not only the agency fee requirement, but includes a "we will not strike" clause. And
okay, so
that was a trade-off.
Okay, gotcha.
But of course,
thanks very much.
There are many public sector laws, bargaining laws, that prohibit public employee strikes, and the union strike anyway.
Okay, thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like, Ray Lushenis, that might be the final audience question. Let me, we still got a couple minutes left. I'll give you a chance to wrap up, see if you have a final thought that you want to express. But as you do that, maybe give us a sense of the timetable. This is another one of those unknowable questions, but a lot of times, based on experience, some of the larger, the higher profile cases wait to the very end of the term to be decided. But as you're suggesting, we've got four firm on each side here. How quickly are we going to get to a decision? Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, that's
the last day.
At the luncheon I went to after the oral argument, Bill Messenger, our attorney who argued the case, was asked that very question.
Yeah.
And I agree with his comment, which was, well, remember, Harris came down the last week of that term. I think Knox also came down the last week of the term it was argued in. So it's most likely it'll be 5-4 and be in the last week. But he said it's also possible, since they basically had, there may have been a draft written in Friedrichs that had already been circulated that they would start with, and so it could come down earlier.
Fascinating. Any other final thoughts before we wrap up?
I guess my final thought is, well, in addition to thanking the Federalist Society for putting on this teleforum and at least, I think, two in advance of the oral argument about Janus, my final thought is that I certainly agree with all of the observers in the public press and in the legal press that this is one of the most important cases of the term. And if we win Janus, it will free some 5 million public employees from the requirement that they pay union fees and give them the choice of joining or not joining voluntarily.
Very good. Well, let me thank you, Ray Lajeunesse, on behalf of the Federalist Society. At the outset, before actually the call began, I asked you to try and play this down the middle to the extent you could and give us both sides of the argument. I think you've done a great job in recapping that.
It's hard. Yes, it is.
It's a lot to ask of an advocate, but I appreciate you doing that. I think it benefits our audience, and I thank you for that. I do want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to check your emails and our website for the next for upcoming Teleforum conference calls. The next scheduled call is tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern time, at this same number. We'll be talking about the Microsoft warrants case, which is set for oral argument tomorrow. The court marches on. But until that next argument, until that next Teleforum, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.